is out. 40 degrees Racine, 41 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jacandrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jacandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on this 20th of April, I am certainly pleased and honored that we can have in our studios not only a frequent guest and friend to the morning show, Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, but also a very special visitor, a guest of Carthage for the last several days, James J. Gelber, who is with the United States Department of Justice. And in his work with the Department of Justice, Mr. Gelber has been involved in an array of fascinating projects and working in several different areas involved in the law. And we're going to be talking with him quite a lot about, first of all, how the Department of Justice is put together and functions, and also about the work of both prosecutors and defense attorneys and how our whole national landscape is made up in terms of federal, state, and local jurisdictions, their relationships to one another. And people who work in the capacity of Mr. Gelber with the Department of Justice often have to navigate that system and have an understanding of it that most of the rest of us don't begin to have. So I'm really excited that we can also speak about all of that and also some of the really interesting work that he has done in the nation of Afghanistan. So we have lots to talk about, and without further ado, a warm welcome again to Dr. Art Sear and to our special guest, James J. Gelber. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much.
Professor Sear, explain how Mr. Gelber comes to Carthage College, what makes his visit possible.
Well, he's a Chapman executive in residence. Steve Chapman and his wife are Carthage parents. They're child is now graduated. He was kind enough to serve for a time on our board of trustees. They endowed this program very generously. He's also a senior executive at Cummins Corporation, now a global manufacturer. It started out as Cummins Engine Company, a global manufacturer of engines, transportation equipment, machinery of all kinds, with a strong interest in Asia. And we, in fact, are doing more all the time by design at our Clausen Center for World Business and at the College on Asia. That's not the topic this morning, except that Afghanistan is in South Asia. But that's the genesis of the program.
And tell us about the specific invitation to Mr. Galber. What made him a compelling choice to be part of this series?
Well, the professional credentials you just mentioned, also coincidentally, is the brother of Cassie Lau, a very effective faculty member in finance and economics and a leader on campus. She chaired the committee that the particularly challenging job to recruit our new director of athletics, the successor to Robert Bond, who's retiring after many very positive and successful years leading a Division III athletic program. Athletics is challenging in every dimension, in every way, and certainly in higher education. And I've been impressed by many dimensions of Carthage, including Mr. Bond's and his associates' work. We did not invite our guest because of his familial relationship, obviously. That would not arise, especially because he's in federal law enforcement, but it was a good opportunity. And the more we can work together on, you know, take advantage of colleagues, what I try to avoid strongly is telling other people what to do at their student assignments, but what we do at the Clausen Center is try to draw on faculty and student and staff interest and expertise.
Very good. Well, we have someone of considerable expertise and experience sitting right here, and it's we're looking forward to getting to know you. Maybe we could start in the most basic sort of way by finding out a little bit about where you are from originally, and in particular, where your interest in the law came from. I mean, is this something where we at least saw hints of it at a relatively early age?
Well, thanks. By the way, before I start answering any questions, I should make two points. First of all, I've worked with the Department of Justice for many years at this point, but I'm here as an individual, and any opinions I express are my opinions. I am not, I repeat, not speaking for the Department of Justice. The other thing I have to say is I appreciate that introduction with all the praise, but it's going to make me doubt the credentials of anybody else I hear on NPR in the future that you describe me that way.
Ah, well, we do like to place things in glowing terms, but I think they're warranted. I really do.
Well, thank you. Well, I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. Went away to college. As I said yesterday, I took a somewhat circuitous route, two colleges in 6 years. While I was in college, I did develop an interest in the law, an interest in sort of, I didn't know any lawyers. I'm not sure I ever met a lawyer until I was in law school, frankly.
Wow.
My parents were educated people, but we had very little money, and we lived in an Italian working-class neighborhood in the Bronx. But I was always interested in history and politics, and I took a couple classes in college on constitutional law, and I became interested, fascinated in sort of the idea of the law. And what I was talking about yesterday to some of the classes, you know, what I consider the theory of the rule of law, and, you know, no person being above the law. It was all theoretical. I didn't know any lawyers, but I was interested in it, and I think anyone who knows me well would tell you that I'm a person of relatively strong opinions, and particularly in my teens and early 20s, happy to argue either side of any position with great gusto.
Interesting. So this course you took in, a course in constitutional law?
Right, that was at Queens College, City University in New York.
Right, and did you just sort of take that by accident or on a lark? I mean, already was there sort of the seed of interest there?
I think there was the seed of interest there, and I have to admit, I don't remember the teacher's name, but it was an excellent course, and it certainly fanned my interest, and I thought about going to law school. I decided I wanted to go to law school. I was also very much I was a history major, economics minor, very interested in the law, but also very interested in economics. And in my senior year, I took the LSATs and did extremely well, and so got accepted into a number of, you know, good law schools, and that's where I went, and I have
settled
to,
for
I've
Harvard.
Been doing
I
it
think.
Ever since. Well, Harvard reluctantly settled for me.
Well, and the rest is history. I suppose it's theoretically possible to be interested in the law, but not necessarily interested in becoming a lawyer. I mean, they're not precisely the same thing. Did you decide at some point that you really wanted to be a lawyer in terms of what that means? Or, I mean, to whatever extent you had even a limited understanding of what that would mean in terms of actually being a practicing lawyer?
It's certainly true that I had a very limited understanding of what it really means to be a lawyer. I mean, even today I have a pretty good understanding of what I do as a lawyer, but you know, what I do as a lawyer is a very small slice of what all lawyers do. I suppose that, well, you can certainly be interested in constitutional law. You can certainly be interested in, you know, theories of governance and the rule of law and things like that without becoming a lawyer. It helps to understand some law to do those things, but you certainly don't have to be a lawyer. But I also like the idea of getting involved in cases, arguing cases, figuring things out. And I felt I was better adapted to that than to being, you know, sort of the solitary researcher. You know, I like to talk, as many students noticed yesterday to their discomfort, I'm sure. But I work better in a team. I work better on projects with a more or less immediate end in sight. You put me in a library and give me 3 years and tell me to come out with a book, you might be disappointed, I think. Certainly when I was younger, you would have been.
Right. Well, of course, a very important component of being a lawyer is serving people and serving the cause of justice. I mean, in a more tangible way versus just theoretically in terms of being surrounded by piles of books and thinking about the law itself, kind of in a sense, apart from real life where the law applies.
Well, that's very true. And certainly, you know, when I was 20, which was, you know, some years ago, I think that was all the clearer to me. And then, you know, I became, you know, went to law school. I graduated. I worked in private practice in New York City for 10 years, two different firms. But what you just said about the idea of some sort of public service did appeal to me very strongly, especially after a few years of work and having, you know, paid off my debts and so forth. And that's how I wound up deciding that I really wanted to work for a U.S. Attorney's Office. And my wife and I and our two small children are living in the middle of Brooklyn. And I was going to have to take a pay cut to become an AUSA anyway. And we were thinking of getting out of Brooklyn. And if I was going to work as an AUSA, it seemed advisable to go someplace where the housing costs were perhaps a little lower. Anyway, I applied for jobs in a number of U.S. attorney's offices in places that I thought would be interesting places to live. And I got a job in the Vermont U.S. Attorney's Office. That was 1989, and I'm still more or less there.
Very good. We're speaking with James J. Gelber, who is with the U.S. Department of Justice. He is actually stationed, if I guess it would be one way to put it, in the offices in Vermont. One of the things you were saying about that office is that because it is a relatively small office, at least compared to other jurisdictions, it's actually an office that sees, in a sense, a lot of action in a lot of different areas versus probably larger offices, larger jurisdictions, where chances are a given person is going to probably find themselves specializing more. You've had to be kind of a jack of all trades in some respects.
That's very true. We have, I think we're up to 18 attorneys in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Vermont, but there are, you know, large U.S. attorney's offices that have hundreds of AUSAs. So if you work in the Southern District of New York or Miami or L.A., you may well spend all your time in one area of the law. You become an expert on that. In Vermont, you're much more likely to handle cases in all the types of cases that we bring. You have to remember, the U.S. attorney's office in each district is, you know, we are the government lawyers. We prosecute cases, obviously, but we also defend civil cases. So, you know, we may, you know, prosecute a drug dealer or someone who does a bank fraud, but we also defend the government if somebody has a medical malpractice claim in the VA hospital down in White River, Vermont, White River Junction, Vermont. But we are the government's lawyers.
Hmm. So you are on both sides of the fence in that respect also. I mean, working both in a prosecutorial capacity in some points and sometimes as defense attorneys. So you do both, and in all kinds of different areas.
I have done some of both. Most people in even in Vermont, most people are either in most people are on the criminal side, and a few people are on the civil side. But most people don't do both, although they do sometimes go from one side to the other and back. But at any one time, most people are either on the in the criminal division or the civil division. One of the reasons is developing a certain amount of expertise, but also the pace of civil cases and criminal cases is very different. So it's tough to have a big caseload on both sides. It's very difficult to manage your calendar.
Sure. This might be a, as good a time as any for us to have you sort out something that I think most of us in just the regular civilian population find a bit confusing, and that is sort of the various tiers that that constitute our criminal justice system here in the United States in terms of things occurring at the federal level and the state level and the local level. I mean, these layers of jurisdiction, I think most of us find that very, very confusing. Can you make it less confusing for us?
I'm not sure the job of a lawyer is to make things less confusing.
Well, I hope you'll give it a try.
I'll do my best. The U.S. Attorney's Office, we say we are the federal government's lawyers, and we appear in federal court. In 29 years as a as an AUSA, an assistant U.S. attorney, I think I, on one occasion, said a couple of words in a state courtroom in Vermont. There, we enforce federal statutes. Congress passes law. I mean, on the criminal side, on the criminal side, Congress passes laws outlawing certain types of activity, and we enforce those laws. On the civil side, there are federal civil laws, such as environmental laws, for instance, and we enforce those. We also defend cases, but if someone sues the United States under some sort of state claim, like I said, someone who, say, a medical malpractice claim in the VA hospital, that's really under, that claim is under state law, just as if you were injured by a doctor, you know, in the clinic down the street. However, if you sue the federal government can, what we call, remove the case into federal court, but it's still a matter of state law. So that gets a little confusing, but
right.
Federal courts enforce federal law, but they also enforce state law if the government is a party. And there's other complications that I won't go into. But states also have, of course, criminal codes. So the Wisconsin has, I'm willing to assume, a state criminal code. And it has the authority in its courts with its prosecutors to prosecute people. So, and most street crime is controlled by state law. So, you know, if you get in a fight in the bar after too many beers and punch somebody out, you're going to be arrested by either a state or a local official, and you're going to be prosecuted under state law for assault or some variant of that. Most murders are state law.
Right.
Now, there usually has to be some, what we call an interstate nexus, to go into federal law. So a murder is not generally going to be prosecuted in federal court. It could be prosecuted in federal court if there's, say, a kidnapping leading to a murder and someone is kidnapping across state lines. It could wind up in federal court if an assault is deemed to be some sort of deprivation or some sort of assault on your civil rights, which are, you know, protected by federal law and the U.S. Constitution. But just your run-of-the-mill street crime is not going to be going to wind up in federal court, not going to be prosecuted by an AUSA.
Right. So it has to rise to a certain level of, in a sense, complexity or be a matter of violation of federal law in
right.
order for
or,
you.
Or if it involves interstate commerce. But there's lots of things that are under both state law and federal law. One of the most common ones are drug cases. Heroin, for instance, is illegal. It's illegal to make it, use it, possess it, sell it under federal law. And I believe it's all those things are also illegal under the law of every state. So if you get picked up with a certain, if you're selling heroin, you might be prosecuted in state court or in federal court. Within each judicial district, there are usually agreements as to who will prosecute what kind of a case. Certainly in Vermont over the years, the larger the case, the more likely it was it would be handled by federal agents, DEA agents, for instance, and federal prosecutors. Smaller cases were generally prosecuted at the state level. Right now, though, with marijuana, and again, I'm speaking for myself, not for the Department of Justice, but right now, there are, until recently, marijuana was illegal under both state law and federal law. There are some states now where marijuana is legal under state law, but it's still illegal under federal law. So you could get arrested. You know, you could be standing in the doorway, I suppose, of a state court in California, you know, smoking marijuana, and be perfectly legal by state law, but get arrested by a DEA agent. Now, DEA agents, in fact, have better things to do than arrest somebody who's happens to be smoking a joint of marijuana.
Right.
But there is a conflict.
In California.
But there is a conflict between the laws there.
Yeah,
and people don't understand that, and it, frankly, it's not that easy to understand.
Right, no. That makes things even more complicated. What about the different responsibilities, then, that, for instance, a prosecutor has versus a defense attorney? Beyond the obvious, that the one is on one side and one is on the other, but I suspect there are complexities about those responsibilities that most of us on the outside looking in just don't begin to understand.
There are the biggest, well, speaking as a prosecutor, which I have been for quite a while, but the job of a prosecutor, and most of us, I think, strive to do this as best we can. But the job of a prosecutor is to enforce the law and to essentially put guilty people in jail. It's not just to win the particular case in front of you. If you have any doubts about whether the person is guilty, you don't prosecute them. And that's both common practice, of course, but it's part of the ethical rules for attorneys. If you are a prosecutor, you cannot bring a case against someone unless you can state two things. First of all, you have to believe that the person committed the crime. And secondly, you have to believe that there is sufficient admissible evidence that a jury could reasonably find the person guilty. That is, if I think you've committed a crime, but I really don't have any evidence, I can't indict you, I can't take you to trial, even though I strongly believe that you did it. I can't just put you on trial and hope that a jury will convict you if I make enough inflammatory statements or something.
Right, or if a Perry Mason thing happens and some magical bit of evidence floats up out of the ether. But
In many years as a prosecutor, Perry Mason has never shown up for me.
Right.
But the difference with a defense attorney, and I don't mean to denigrate them here. I have many good friends who are defense attorneys. But their job is to try to get their client off. So a defense attorney may know perfectly well that the client is guilty. He may know perfectly well that there's plenty of evidence that could convict him. But if the defense attorney can, for instance, in some way, you know, using the rules of evidence, if a defense attorney can keep out some strong evidence and therefore have his client acquitted, that's what he's supposed to do. I mean, he's obliged to do that by the ethical rules.
Or to get them off on a technicality.
Absolutely.
Or whatever it might be. And so there is no responsibility for a defense attorney to believe that his or her client is innocent. They might believe one or the other or not be certain at all, but that has nothing to do with the work that they do as a defense attorney, and that makes them very different from the prosecutor. I mean,
yeah, it is very different. Some people love that kind of work. Some people don't. One of the other differences also on a sort of technical level is as a prosecutor, you have to put the whole case together. There are elements to each crime, and you have to prove each element. The defense attorney's job is different. It's kind of like, you know, if I'm trying to build a bridge, the defense attorney doesn't have to prove that the whole bridge is defective. If they pull out one stone, the thing collapses. I've got to put all the stones together.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there are, of course, advantages from as a prosecutor, you have, you know, investigators, and you have the time to put a case together and bring evidence into court. So there are advantages and disadvantages technically, but there is a difference in that we have to put the whole case together and convince a jury or a judge that we can, that each piece of the case is proved, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. They only have to introduce doubt as the one important part.
Right. Mm-hmm. When you are in the courtroom, what are sort of the most important things for you to accomplish? And I'm especially asking this in contrast to what most of us know about legal proceedings, which is from what we see on television, on highly fictionalized television series. And of course, that's just not the way things typically play out at all. And in particular, I suspect that real life has a lot less to do with the rhetorical relish of attorneys than it does on your typical legal drama on television. What are the most important things you need to try to achieve in the courtroom?
Well, first of all, let me state that it has very little resemblance to most courtroom dramas. I have to say that my wife refuses to watch any TV show or movie with significant courtroom scenes with me because because watching it on TV makes me so crazy.
Right.
But there's two different things that are important. First of all, on a purely technical basis, if you go into court, you need to know your case. You need to know your evidence, and you have to know particularly, you have to know exactly how each bit of evidence is going to come into court. You may have statements, you may have bank records, you may have tapes, you have witnesses, but there are rules by which each of those things can be admitted into evidence. If you don't have that set forth in advance, you don't have a case. You may have all the evidence in the world, but you don't have the person who can authenticate the tape. You may have a great picture, and the witness who's going to come in and just say, yes, that picture looks like the scene on the day of the crime. Mm. You don't have that person. That picture's not going into evidence. Mm. So that sounds really picky, but it's something you always have to be thinking about. You can't get so caught up in the overall message that you don't get your exhibits into evidence. One of the things that prosecutors tend to say, you know, hey, how's the trial going? Witnesses showed up, exhibits went into evidence. It means it's going well. The process is going well.
Right, and that's process and the nuts and bolts of it is something we're never shown on television. I mean, that would be bad television.
It would be terrible television. I mean, one of the things you have to worry about as a prosecutor is you have to worry about putting the jury to sleep. But there are things that have to go in. If you're doing a fraud case, and at this point in my life, I'm doing, you know, white collar work. But if you bring doing a fraud case, bank records are really important. Bank records are not in and of themselves fascinating. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get your bank statement at the end of the month, well, you may look at it and you may not. But if you do look at it, you know, you don't stay up late at night and think, wow, what a wonderful, fascinating bank statement this is.
Someone should make a movie about this.
Exactly. But so you have to. So part of what you're doing is, you know, following the rules, getting the evidence in front of the jury, getting the evidence onto the record. But the other part of it is presentation is important, of course, and you don't want to put the jury to sleep. You don't want to put the judge to sleep. You don't want the judge to get angry at you or the jurors to get angry at you because you're boring them, you're taking too long. So there's sort of a delicate balance about getting in what you need to get in and either putting the jury to sleep or getting them angry at you. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that you have to do is you can't get so caught up in the technicalities that you lose some sort of human connection with the jurors and with the judge. I mean, if the jurors and the judge either think that you don't care about what you're doing or if they, for some reason, decide that you are trying to trick them, you will probably lose that case.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So. What does your relationship tend to be with your opponents? And by that I mean the attorneys on the other side of whatever case is being argued. How often are these attorneys with whom you have some familiarity, how often is it even a relationship that at least remotely resembles a friendship, or by and large, is there not that sense of connection with opponents in what you do?
Well, particularly in Vermont, which is, you know, a small, not heavily populated state.
Right.
In Vermont, you see the same defense attorneys over and over. And it is very rare for us not to be at least cordial, quite cordial. Chat, shake hands, talk about, you know, people. You may know a little bit about their kids, that sort of stuff. You chat about that. There are some of them with whom I'm have personal friends, people that I've been to their house for dinner, they've been to my house for dinner. Yeah. There are some that I, you know, some that I like better than others, but it's always at least professional, and it's usually at least, it's almost always cordial, and occasionally it's a real friendship. Mm-hmm. So, but as with prosecutors, I think the same is true of defense attorneys, that most of the defense attorneys are doing the best job they can, and most of them are doing it in an honorable way. There are, I'm sure a defense attorney would say that there are some prosecutors who try to bend the law or try to get evidence in that shouldn't come in or bring cases that maybe shouldn't be brought. And there are some defense attorneys that I think do bend the law or try to coach witnesses in avoiding the truth, shall we say. But I think most of them do their job in an honorable way. Now, in D.C., where I'm working now, I've met a number of defense attorneys, but you're not likely to see the same people over and over. Of course, I've only been there for a little over 2.5 years now.
Right.
But obviously, there's a lot more lawyers in Washington, D.C. than there are in Vermont.
No doubt.
There may be more lawyers in Washington than there are people in Vermont.
Right. For those of you just joining us,
in Washington, D.C. would be a very poor joke.
For those of you just joining us, our special guest on the morning today is James J. Gelber, who is with the United States Department of Justice. Mr. Gelber, some of the most important and interesting work that you've done has been in the investigation of fraud in Afghanistan. And just to be clear, at least for the most part, what you are doing is not targeting Afghan citizens, but targeting U.S. citizens who one way or another are engaged in fraud in terms of the spending of U.S. funds in Afghanistan. First of all, give us a sense of the kind of wrongdoing that we're talking about, the kind of fraud that is going on that you are investigating. And maybe you can also give us a sense of kind of the scope of it. I mean, the more modest cases versus the really kind of sprawling cases of fraud that you are also pursuing.
Okay, that's kind of an open-ended question there, but I'll try. Okay, as I've said, I'm an AUSA in Vermont. I'm working in the fraud section of the Criminal Division of Department of Justice. But I am funded, this current job, I am funded by an organization known as SIGAR, S-I-G-A-R, which stands for Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. And SIGAR is, well, every federal agency has an inspector general. But because of the amount of money being spent in Afghanistan, Congress, and by the way, I'm not speaking on behalf of SIGAR, these are my opinions, but Congress established SIGAR some years ago because of the amount of money being spent in Afghanistan. So the Special Inspector General has all the authority of an Inspector General in any other agency, but only with regard to money being spent in Afghanistan. And, you know, as you may have heard, there's been a significant amount of money spent in Afghanistan. SIGAR has a number of investigators and auditors in Afghanistan, and it also has an office with investigators and auditors and others in Northern Virginia. What I do, and another attorney, and we're just in the process of hiring a third, what we do is help investigators do their investigations, consult with them on investigations, and if we think there's enough evidence, bring cases against people in the U.S., in U.S. court. As you said, we do not prosecute Afghans. We prosecute U.S. persons. If we're prosecuting an Afghan, it would be a dual citizen, a person who's an Afghan citizen but has come to the U.S. And gotten legal status in the U.S. The cases range very widely. It can be a soldier who, you know, was in charge of the fuel dump at a base and selling fuel to Afghans and, you know, for cash and sending the cash back home. It can be contractors. There's lots and lots of contractors who are either stealing materials. Can be contractors who are entering into subcontracts with Afghan companies and taking kickbacks. I just handled a case like that, without naming the district or the name of the person, but I just wrapped up a case like that about a month ago. But it also can be much larger cases. There are enormous contracts, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars or more, and it can be corruption in how those contracts were awarded. There can be fraud in how people won those contracts, or there can be fraud in the billing of those contracts. So a company may be, you know, regularly billing the United States government or the United States military, or, you know, State Department, USAID, saying that it accomplished certain things, and maybe it wasn't really accomplishing those things. And it's tough to, especially as we have withdrawn forces within Afghanistan, it's more difficult to check. It's difficult to go out and see what's actually been done. At this point, you know, if somebody tells you they've built, you know, schools in a remote province in Afghanistan, you can't just drive out there and take a look at it.
Right.
There are times I have been told that people have tried to locate these schools and maybe they're not there.
Wow.
But of course, maybe they are there and we're paying for, you know, for teachers in those schools. The school may be there. There may be teachers on a payroll, but there may not be teachers in the school. Now, let me say, in my opinion, I'm strongly in favor of us maintaining our presence in Afghanistan. This is me. This is Jim Gelber, the history major. And you know, I worked in Afghanistan for over 15 months some years ago and loved the place and loved most of the people. So I think we should be doing what we can for it. But I also think that, you know, as a prosecutor, I think that we should be watching how we're spending our money. And it's difficult to do it there.
Right. Who are the sort of the boots on the ground that are kind of doing that aspect of this work? I mean, who do we have in Afghanistan what are the means by which these kind of investigations can take place in a place like Afghanistan?
Well, SIGAR has investigators in Kabul and also up at Bagram Air Base. In the past, we've had investigators in a number of other places. But, you know, we have many fewer bases in Afghanistan than we did just a few years ago.
Right.
But those investigators do get out. Those investigators go have some mobility, not as much as perhaps they used to. There are other agencies that have investigators there, although I think I can say the SIGAR has more investigators there than anybody else. But particularly DCIS, the Defense Criminal Investigation Service, has investigators there, and we work with them. They are sort of the primary agency because, obviously, our military is spending, has a lot of people and spending a whole lot of money over there.
Right.
And thank goodness for them. Yeah.
As someone who's lived in Afghanistan and knows Afghan citizens and has seen the country up close and worked there, what can you say about the legal system there? And I wish our listeners could see the grimace on your face as I got to that point. I suspect that it is really complicated, and in particular, there may be other sort of outside factors that tend to maybe interfere and make it a murkier system than it might otherwise be.
It is a very murky system. When I worked there, I worked there for over 15 months from early 2010 to sort of the middle of 2011. And when I was working there, I was not working as a prosecutor. The Department of Justice then had a small program where experienced AUSAs, assistant U.S. attorneys, were there to work with, to train, to mentor Afghan prosecutors and to some extent Afghan judges, although mostly prosecutors. And what I learned when I was there was that the Afghan legal system was far more complicated than I had understood or anyone had told me.
Hmm.
It's interesting, and I've learned, tried to learn more about it since I came back. And I actually taught a course at Middlebury College for a January term on this. But there's different sources of law in Afghanistan. I mean, they have written legal codes. They have a written constitution, I mean, just like we do. But to a significant extent, the written legal code there was written for them and to some extent imposed on them by the West, not just the United States by any means, but by the West following 9/11 when Western forces went into Afghanistan and dislodged the Taliban. You know, Afghanistan had been at war at that point pretty much since 1977. It was a desperately poor country to start with right. limited infrastructure and institutions. And these Western legal codes were somewhat imposed on them as a condition of some of the aid that they were getting. And I think it's fair to say that when you try to impose something as important as a legal system, a jurisdictional system, you're liable to get a lot of pushback. And I think there has been a lot of pushback. But there are, in addition to this sort of Western legal code, there is also Islamic law. Afghanistan is an Islamic country. The Constitution, for instance, says that no law can be passed which contravenes the tenets of Islam. And it's not clear, I think, to Western eyes what that really means. I thought it meant that, you know, that the Afghan parliament couldn't pass a law that specifically imposed something in violation of the Quran. That's not, at least an Islamic legal scholar might not see it that way at all. I talked to in Afghanistan, you can, if you go to law school, you can go to a law school that teaches law more or less the Western tradition, but you can also go to law school and learn law in the Islamic Sharia tradition. Mm-hmm. And you can become a judge based on either background. And the Islamic tradition, and I am certainly no scholar on that, dubious whether I'm a scholar on anything, but certainly in the Islamic tradition, the rules of evidence are very different. The weight, how evidence is weighed, is very different. So you could have, there's no juries in Afghanistan. Every case has three judges. You could easily have, you know, one Western-type judge and two Islamic judges on a case, or vice versa.
Wow.
And as a defendant, or I suppose as a prosecutor, you don't necessarily know which you're going to get in any case. So it's very different. But to go back to what I was saying before, I remember talking to a specific judge, seemingly very learned man, very gracious to us, but he wasn't really, what he told us was that he really couldn't discuss Sharia law, you know, because we wanted to ask him, you know, what he considered, say, the burden of proof, or how evidence would be admitted, you know, things of that nature, which were important to us to try to understand how law was being applied there. But he said he really couldn't discuss that with us unless we could discuss it with him in Arabic. I don't speak Arabic, but almost no one in Afghanistan does. It's not one of the national languages of Afghanistan.
Wow.
So if you really can't discuss the law that he thought should be applied in all of Afghanistan, if you can't discuss that in the language, any of the languages of the country, that's a pretty undemocratic way to run things.
No kidding. Wow. So...
Let me say one other thing.
Yeah.
Out in the much of Afghanistan, well, almost all of Afghanistan is very poor. Historically, and still true today, much of Afghanistan is deserts, it's mountains, it's subsistence farming. And most of the regions are pretty distinct from each other. There's different ethnic groups. Much of the hinterlands have traditionally had very little interaction with the central government. And so the Western codes of law, which have been tried for various times over the 20th century, have had very little application to much of the population. Much of the population essentially lives under some sort of traditional law, you know, unwritten law, but binding, but as applied by, you know, sort of the village elders. And it often, there's often little distinction between civil law and criminal law. There's no jails. Much, the punishment for many crimes is what they call restorative. So if I hurt you in a fight, I don't go to jail, but maybe I have to give you, you know, a few sheep or something. But it's binding because in a small village, if you can't get along with the village, you really can't live there. If you're a farmer, you know, and everybody in the village shares a certain amount of irrigation water coming down from, you know, from the snow melt, if you're not going to get your water, you can't live there. So it's binding, but it's unwritten, and it's largely unknown to Westerners.
As a Westerner who was there to help some of the people wanting to work, for instance, as prosecutors, I guess, or investigators in FA, do you feel like in the end you were able to offer meaningful help, given the fact that we're talking about a system so different from our own? If you feel like you were helpful, in what way do you think you were helpful?
I think we, because we had, you know, there were a number of Americans working there. There still are a couple people working there for the Department of Justice. And we were also working with British prosecutors. I think that we were on the margin. I think that, particularly when working with young prosecutors there, they were very happy to have us there. And I think there were two things that we were helpful in. One is, they were very poorly educated. They were very poorly trained. We were trying to teach them to analyze a case. I talked before about a prosecutor having to prove all the elements of his case.
Right.
Well, you don't know how to prove all the elements of your case if you don't analyze your case as to what the elements are. I mean, that's a real basic thing for us. Most of them had never thought about cases that way. That's a real basic thing. That's something we spent a lot of time on. We tried to encourage them to work with investigators, to work with prosecutors at different levels. It's a multi-level system there. The other thing that we could do to some extent is that we could provide a little bit of protection, sort of political protection, from interference from above. I mean, it's not a secret here to say that there's corruption in Afghanistan. And I will certainly say that in 2010, 2011, there was corruption at very high levels. And so important people, powerful people in Afghanistan just assume as a matter of course that they can interfere in the legal system, either by paying people off or just because they are important people and people like prosecutors should do what they say. I've gone into prosecutors' offices there and found people that didn't want to talk to me. And generally speaking, Afghans are extremely courteous. But if you go and say somebody really doesn't want to talk to you, it's striking when that happens. And I found out on several occasions that these people were members of parliament who were there to try to get somebody off.
Wow.
So to some extent, we could offer technical assistance, technical training, and to some extent, we could offer a little bit of political protection so that cases could go forward.
Wow. Well, I should think being in a place like Afghanistan gives you maybe in a sense a new appreciation and even understanding of our own legal system here. And thank goodness for as complicated as it is and how it occasionally fails us in ways big and small, this is not Afghanistan where we live. and it's good to know that good folks, ethical folks like James Gelber are on the case, on the side of justice for all and the rule of law overall. James Gelber, I'm really glad that you could join us today to talk a bit about the interesting work that you have done. And it's certainly a pleasure and honor to have you as a Chapman visitor visiting the executive at Carthage and a guest on the morning show today. It's been my honor and pleasure to speak with you, and I thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. It's been fascinating. I just realized how long I've been talking. Like lots of lawyers, I talk too much.
Not at all.